WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. This week, the nation marked the death of President George Herbert Walker Bush at 94. Former President George W. Bush eulogized his father.
He strongly believed that it was important to give back to the community and country in which one lived. He recognized that serving others enriched the giver's soul. To us, his was the brightest of a thousand points of light.
Meanwhile, President Trump's tweets embracing tariffs, paired with the arrest of a top official of a leading Chinese tech company, Huawei, caused whiplash on Wall Street. Here's CNBC's Frank Holland.
The Dow had been down as much as 785 points on Thursday on fears of rising trade tensions between the U.S. and China.
Join us. How do you remember George H.W. Bush? What values endure? What parts of his record might we be overlooking? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. With us from Houston is Lisa Falkenberg, vice president and editor of opinion at the Houston Chronicle. In 2015, she won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary for her columns on social issues and probably is lucky enough never to have to bring that up, but we're happy to. Lisa, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, David.
And with us from Washington is Franco Ordonez. He's White House correspondent for McClatchy and also host of the podcast Majority Minority. Franco, great to have you with us.
Hi, David. Thanks for being here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's own news analyst Jack Beatty. Hey, Jack.
Hello, David, Lisa, and Franco.
Well, we do have news to offer you right now that has just come across the transom. The president of the United States, President Trump, has said that he's going to have two nominations for us. He's told reporters he's going to nominate William Barr as the U.S. Attorney General. Barr, of course, a former U.S. Attorney General. And he's going to nominate a spokeswoman from the State Department, Heather Nauert, to be the ambassador to the United Nations from the U.S. Franco, you cover the White House. So what do you make of the Barr appointment?
It's a very interesting move. I mean, here is someone that who worked for H.W. Bush. Not as much is known about him as others who have been talked about. In a way, he kind of came a little bit out of the blue. Certainly he has a record. He's been around. He has talked about Clinton in the past. For example, he has kind of spoken some of the Trump lines about Clinton emails, and she should have been investigated a little more investigated. So that's certainly something that would ring with the Trump supporters. But I think. I think this is something that there's going to be a lot more digging because he's certainly not seen, at least at this point, as like a rabble rouser who is going to go and, throw, a cape around Trump to protect him from this investigation.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, William Barr is both, as Franco says, a member of the establishment, an attorney general for George H.W. Bush, but also somebody who said, hey, Trump was right to fire Jim Comey as head of the FBI, even though he was leading an investigation into questions about his own circle's activities. What do you remember of William Barr? What should we expect of him?
Well, he actually played a role in a dubious piece of business at the end of the Bush administration. That is, in the offering of pardons to Caspar Weinberger, former Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, and several other people involved in the Iran-Contra scandal. That was a whitewash. That was a cover-up. And one of the things it covered up was perhaps President George H.W. Bush's involvement in the Iran-Contra matter and his knowledge of it. And Barr was the attorney general then who worked through these pardons. So he's alive to us on the pardon issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly a figure for whom that will be exhumed, and yet nonetheless somebody widely respected. I'd like to turn to the man who was the first to nominate William Barr to be attorney general, and that, of course, is George H.W. Bush, laid to rest this week, eulogized at the Washington National Cathedral Memorial Service on Wednesday. Former President George W. Bush eulogized his father, George H.W. Bush, who, of course, died last Friday at the age of 94.
When the history books are written, they will say that George H.W. Bush was a great president of the United States, a diplomat of unmatched skill, a commander-in-chief of formidable accomplishment, and a gentleman who executed the duties of his office with dignity and honor.
Lisa Falkenberg, thinking a few days after his memorial service, that memorial service, what did you learn that perhaps you didn't know about President Bush, or what did you remember that perhaps we didn't immediately recall about him?
Mm-hmm. Well, it depends where you're standing. People have different perspectives. I mean, here in Texas, there was just this outpouring of love and support yesterday as he was his remains were transported to burial. He was aboard a train, Union Pacific train. People lined for miles and miles, thousands of people, to wave flags and to say goodbye. And so he was a statesman, much beloved here. But at the same time, like many presidents, there were juxtapositions during his presidency, his leadership. I mean, the No New Taxes pledge, all of us are familiar with Dana Carvey's, you know, wouldn't be prudent to cross between John Wayne and Mr. Rogers, as he said. But, you know,
the master of malaprop in some ways.
Yes, yes. Although not as much as his son.
Right.
And then there was, you know, he had to kind of overcome the wimp persona because he was always in the shadow of Reagan. At the same time, he was this war hero who nearly died in his service as a Navy pilot. He was much celebrated for his part in the ADA, the American Disabilities Act. And at the same time, you know, he's been roundly criticized for his inaction on AIDS. You look at Iraq, and you know, it was a time of great pride for the nation because many of us had never—I was a kid at the time. Many of us had never been through war, didn't understand what that was like. But at the same time, many would say he didn't get the job done.
He got the Iraqis out of Kuwait and didn't go after them back into Baghdad, right?
Well, he left Saddam Hussein in place, and so that's— you know, that's the question of how much that influenced what his son did later.
Lisa, I wonder if I could also ask you to talk a little bit. You're there in Houston where he made his base for many decades. On the one hand, he's a guy who, you know, was a son of a Connecticut senator, in some ways the apex of the WASP establishment, a son of Andover and Yale. And yet he thought of himself in many ways as a Texan. How did Texans think about him?
I think people accepted him. I mean, this is a place, especially Houston, but this is a place where, you know, people can speak derogatorily about new money. But, you know, this is a place where you can come and it's a land of opportunity and there's a lot of outsiders. We don't really use the term carpetbaggers very much. This is not the old South in that way. And so we're used to newcomers. We invite them. And this is a place where, you know, if you got the will, if you got the drive, and the talent, you know, you can go out and make something of yourself. And I think that that's what he did in his Studebaker, you know, when he drove out to West Texas. And that's what he did when he came to Houston. And so, yeah, it was very much adopted as a Texan, whether or not he likes pork rinds or not.
I'd like to take a call now from Rapid City, South Dakota. Brad, your thoughts?
How are you? I have very personal memories of George H.W. Bush. Mm-hmm. I lived in Dallas-Fort Worth for many years, and I helped build the Texas Vietnam Veterans Memorial in the mid to late 80s, mm-hmm. which was kind of a long process. And on Veterans Day in 1989, 29 years ago, I guess, he came to Texas and dedicated that Texas Vietnam Veterans Memorial. I didn't get to meet him, but I was sitting about 20 feet from him when he got up to speak. So I have very personal memories of that. Of him coming to Texas to do that.
Well, thank you so much for that, Brad. I appreciate it. On Wednesday, John Meacham, the presidential historian and biographer of George H.W. Bush, delivered the first eulogy at Washington National Cathedral, which he shared with the president before the president's death. And he described Bush as, quote, America's last great soldier statesman.
He governed with virtues that most closely resemble those of Washington and of Adams, of T.R. and of F.D.R., of Truman and of Eisenhower, of men who believed in causes larger than themselves.
Jack Beatty, even as we eulogize and honor George H.W. Bush, that's some pretty lofty company. How does that assessment hold up?
Well, Frederick Jackson Turner, the dean of American history, wrote, "Each age writes the history of the past anew, with reference to the conditions uppermost in its own time. And George H.W. Bush's reputation is being inflated, renewed now, because of one person, really, Donald Trump. Mr. Bush incarnated the things that Mr. Meacham was talking about, honor, integrity, decency, things you cannot find in Trump. And there's a sort of so that raises his stock just because that's the condition uppermost. Two mm-hmm. other things could change that one. I mentioned one of them, the Weinberger pardons. This mm-hmm. was a serious matter the president did just weeks before he left office. The independent prosecutor said that the Iran-Contra cover-up has now been completed, and that Mr. Bush had essentially done that partly to protect himself from revelations that would have come out in the trial of Caspar Weinberger. That's one thing that could change his reputation. A second and even graver matter. Bush's chief of staff, John Sununu, who had a doctorate from MIT, single-handedly, almost, it goes some way to some exaggeration, killed the effort, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It was an international group that was talking about freezing emissions even then in 1989, and he scuppered it. And since then, more carbon has gone into the air than in the entire history of civilization. That's a heavy blow to have on your record.
Even as many praise what was thought of as a pragmatic Republican's approach to some environmental issues, an important point there from Jack Beatty. I'd like Lisa Falkenberg and Franco Ordonez, please stick around. We'd like you to stick around. We're talking about the week's top stories. We'd like you to join our conversation. We'd like to ask you, how are trade tensions with China affecting your livelihood? Would tariffs hurt your bottom line or help it? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the week in the news. You can join our conversation. The Mueller investigation appears to be relentlessly closing in on figures close to the president. What do you take from what we've learned? And how do you feel about our ties to the Saudis, given all we've learned? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests this hour are Lisa Falkenberg of the Houston Chronicle, Franco Ordonez of McClatchy, and On Point's own Jack Beatty. I want to turn now to our relations with China. There were a couple of incidents that happened this week. I want first to Franco Ordonez, to the president's own making nice with the Chinese, and then his own tweets about tariffs, calling himself, if I recall correctly, Tariff Man. What was the president getting on about?
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, talk about whiplash. Certainly the president, in Argentina, and I was there for the G20, he had, touted that he had reached an agreement to kind of put the tariff war at a standstill. They were working on a deal. It created a lot of attention, a lot of excitement, especially in for example, the Midwest, where there's a lot of soybean farmers who are very concerned about these tariffs. Just a couple of days later, he tweeted out, as you pointed out, that he was going to be tariff man, and he threatened, to continue the tariffs. And then there's this investigation also with the Chinese technological company, Huawei.
Let me just stop you there, because we actually have a clip. So to just drill down on that, it's Meng Wanzhou. She's a top executive with Chinese telecommunications giant Huawei. She's arrested on Saturday. It's that same day Trump's dining with President Xi Jinping. And National Security Advisor John Bolton went on Morning Edition in an interview that aired today, in which Bolton pointed to the administration's concerns about tech firms stealing American intellectual property.
We've had enormous concern for years in this country about the practice of Chinese firms to use stolen American intellectual property to engage in forced technology transfers. So not respecting this particular arrest, but Huawei is one company we've been concerned about. There are others as well. I think this is going to be a major subject of the negotiations that President Trump and President Xi Jinping agreed on in Buenos Aires.
So, Franco Ordonez, how does this affect or scramble things?
It affects them very much. Certainly, global investors have been very concerned about the back and forth. In China, they are looking at this very much so as a political attack. It raises a lot of questions about the solidity of any agreement that Trump says he reached with the Chinese in Buenos Aires. And frankly, it also sends a message to the rest of the world. I've talked to a lot of diplomats about these kind of issues, how one of the great things about the United States is being able to count on the word of the president, the word of the sitting administration. And this is another example of many that, you know, kind of the only thing that is predictable in this administration is the unpredictability of it.
We've got a call from Palm City, Florida. Chris, you're on the air. You've had some experience that affects your thinking on this, it sounds like.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yes, I'm in the electronics distribution business, and putting tariffs on piece parts, the parts that build computers, has actually made it more expensive to build those computers in the United States. So the tariff should have been placed on finished goods, like a finished notebook or a finished desktop computer, which then would have ramped up, hopefully tried to ramp up production of those devices in the States. But now all they've done is, you know, caused it even more expensive to make those devices or bring those parts in to make those devices in the United States.
Chris, just to be clear, so you're saying the way in which things are put together, even if it's what we think of as something manufactured in the U.S., it relies on parts from outside, from China, from other places, and it's messing up with the ability to price that competitively.
Correct.
Huh, fascinating. Thanks so much for that call, Chris. Lisa, you must talk to people in Houston all the time, business leaders, maybe labor leaders, other folks. How are they thinking about the way in which the president is approaching trade, particularly with China?
Well, most of the focus here is on NAFTA, or has been, but this is, of course, a state that's friendly to free trade. In fact, it's one of the few areas that our governor Greg Abbott, who's usually pretty much in lockstep with President Trump, has spoken out and in support of free trade. But I mean, you know, I don't know about you, but I find myself checking labels more than I used to. What exactly is made in China? How's this going to affect me? I think I was seeing a Princeton analysis that was estimating for the average American family, you know, this is a cost of $127 more a year. But then if you're building a house, that increase in lumber and other supplies that you'll need is about $9,000. But, you know, anything, I'm going to be buying a car. My Subaru is pretty much on its last leg, so I'm going to be buying a car soon. Is that going to be more expensive? Just clothing, cosmetics, anybody who shops at Gap, Walmart, all of us will be affected by it in our daily lives.
I want to turn now to the investigation that's been ongoing on various fronts into what the president was up to, his circle was up to, and what the Russians were up to during the 2016 elections. And that's obviously gone on in a number of different ways. CNN and other news organizations are reporting that former FBI Director James Comey, even as we speak, is engaged in closed-door interviews right now on Capitol Hill. And of course, there's the Mueller investigation itself. Jack Beatty, why don't you tell us about what we've learned so far this week and what you think it means as sort of there's an accretion of disclosures about what went on and what's going on.
Well, I think the riddle of the week is the 23 redacted lines in the submission, Mueller's submission about General Flynn, 23 redacted lines. And that follows on a section in which a new front, at least to people watching it, was opened in the inquiry. We know about investigation into collusion. We know about the investigation into obstruction of justice. There is apparently also a criminal inquiry in which General Flynn, to which General Flynn gave, and this I'm quoting from the Mueller memo, quote, substantial assistance. What is that criminal inquiry? Who's involved in it? This is a very serious matter. No one knew anything about it. It's out there, and it's hard to imagine a more significant development, even though, as I say, it's redacted. We'll undoubtedly find out more about it.
Michael Flynn, of course, the president's national security advisor, also I think one of the few figures that we know of who's been indicted, who played a role both on the campaign and in the administration itself. But there are other things at stake. We're going to learn more about Paul Manafort and about Michael Cohen. Franco Ordonez, how much of a concern are these developments to the president himself?
They're huge concerns. I mean, you can see that, every week in, the tweets that he puts out about no collusion, about fake media, about, attacking any type of article that comes out. It's really fascinating watching, for me, like, for example, the Michael Cohen developments about he has really jumped ship from the Trump team, and he's putting all of his eggs in the basket of Mueller and trying to cooperate as much as he can. You have the Flynn.
Cohen being the former personal lawyer of the president.
Exactly. And you have Flynn getting, a suggested deal that with of no prison time. And that's certainly something that Cohen is angling for by cooperating as much as he can, by admitting that he had lied to Congress. But it's interesting because he is, not only was he the advisor, but he was also a lawyer. And it'll be interesting to see what happens, considering that the Justice Department often kind of frowns on lawyers acting in criminal behavior because they not only want to send a message to the public, but also to the profession itself. So I think it's a little bit different, but it is fascinating watching. I think there's no question that Mueller is trying to send a message to anybody who cooperates and that you need to stick to your deal.
Well, Franco, tell us what message Mueller's been trying to send through the new court filings on Paul Manafort. There's the former campaign chairman for President Trump. It looked as though he's cooperating. Then he says, hey, this guy's been lying to us all over again.
Yeah, I talked to some former federal prosecutors about this, and the message was, look, if you are going to agree with – if you are going to reach an agreement with me, you are going to have to be on our team and we are going to have to work together. You are not going to be able to give a certain version of the truth that works to your benefit. You cannot lie to us. You need to be trustworthy and forward. And the what I was told is that the prosecution does not very clearly prosecutors do not like their those who they reach plea agreements with to not tell them the truth, to turn around, and that this is a message to Manafort and to others that if you turn around, we can rip up the plea agreement. And one federal prosecutor was telling me very clearly that in the agreement that was reached, there's no, you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that you did not tell the truth. It is up to the discretion of Mueller. If he just has a good faith thought that Mueller is not being, if Manafort is not being completely honest, that he can rip up that agreement. So Manafort's in big danger and it sends a message to everyone else.
I want to take a call now from Wheelock, Vermont. Lincoln, you're on the air. Go ahead, Lincoln.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I had a couple of comments. I'd just like to say, first of all, as far as Russian collusion in the voting, all this whole issue, it's like not one Russian citizen voted in America, okay? So, I mean, our presidents go around and they make endorsements for people. And secondly, I wanted to make a point that this is a tremendous waste of resources because, I mean, when Reagan was in office, it was, I don't recall, worked so well for him. And I think the president is so insulated from anything that's going to touch him. It's just a waste of resources when our FBI could be doing so much more to protect the country than chasing around these emails and collusion and all this other stuff. It's just ridiculous.
You're ready for this to go to bed?
Yeah, put it to bed. Put it to rest.
Bed.
I mean, the American people are just sick of it.
All right. Lincoln says put it to bed. Lisa Falkenberg, How do you think through the issue of this extraordinary devotion of time and resources, obviously something that occupies the president's mind space as he reveals daily, sometimes hourly on Twitter? How do you parse through the service that's being provided or the disservice that's being provided by that probe?
Well, you know, I think a lot of people in Texas feel the way that the caller feels. They're tired of it. I saw a recent NPR poll that showed that, you know, people who have a positive view of Mueller has, you know, those people, the percentage has decreased. And plenty of Republicans think this is a witch hunt. I guess my question is, why were the emails of Hillary Clinton worth a lot of time and resources to investigate? But whether or not our president colluded and people on his staff colluded with a foreign, at this point, adversary, why is that not worth resources? This comes down to one thing for me, and that is whether we can trust our president. The fact that Mueller has found we cannot trust the people that the president surrounds himself with, and the fact that we now know that there's a lot we don't know after seeing Flynn's heavily, you know, redacted memo, I think that tells us there's more going on than we know. And I think we should sit tight and trust a very well-respected man to handle the situation and get to the bottom of it before we just say, let's let it go.
You know, the president's received a lot of support, perhaps a surprising level given the at times ambivalence that senators, even of his own party, have expressed towards him. He's gotten a fair amount of support on the question of Mueller in a quiet way. But there's been some peeling off when it comes to the question of how the president has handled Saudi Arabia, how the president has handled the question of aiding the Saudis in their attacks on Yemen, and particularly about the question of the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. On Tuesday, South Carolina's Republican Senator Lindsey Graham said the evidence suggesting that Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had ordered the murder of Khashoggi was incontrovertible.
There's not a smoking gun, there's a smoking saw. You have to be willfully blind not to come to the conclusion that this was orchestrated and organized by people in under the command of MBS, and that he was intricately involved in the demise of Mr. Khashoggi.
Jack Beatty, what do you take from the fact that some of the president's supporters on Capitol Hill are openly not just distancing themselves from the Saudis and from the president's stance towards it, but very adamantly criticizing it in this way?
I think it has a lot to do with the election results. Even the Republican senators are getting the message that the aura, the bubble of protection around him is thinning. Now the Senate may take up a resolution on Yemen, stopping our aid to that slaughter, and the House will not go along with that. This House won't, the Republican House, but it's very significant. But you know, here we are. We're talking about the death of the first President Bush, and people rightly talking about his honor and integrity and so on. We can't talk about the president's amazing decision to throw over what seems to be the complete verdict of his CIA and the senators and say, oh, no, I don't want to. We're not going to go there. He even said the crown prince hates this even more than I do. Ridiculous statement. We can't talk about that without bringing out what came out in The Washington Post just the other day. Mm-hmm. Just around the period of the inauguration, the Saudi government, through a lobbyist, paid for 500 hotel rooms for veterans to come and lobby for various things on Capitol Hill. 500 hotel rooms at the Trump International Hotel. This is the issue is Mr. Trump protecting his own financial interests in protecting the Saudi prince? We don't know, and we can't avoid those questions because Mr. Trump's, we don't know his taxes, and he has not, he has not put his holdings in a blind trust.
I want to very briefly take a call, Pat. We don't have a lot of time, but Pat is patiently waiting on the air from Baltimore, Maryland. Pat, go ahead on this.
Yes, I absolutely think we need to complete our relationship with Saudi Arabia, and that it's a question of the soul of America. and whether or not we're going to, and I hate to use the word sold, but I think it's more understandable by regular people, that if we go by what the good book says, or the Bible says, after Noah landed, God said, if any human being kills another human being, there will be justice to pay.
Pat is calling for justice to pay. He's saying we should break with Saudi Arabia. That is his thoughts. We're discussing the top stories this week. And interested in your thoughts, you can join our conversation. What about these severe power plays in Wisconsin and Michigan? What does that say to you about politics and democracy? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. You can join our conversation. We're talking right now about power plays in state capitals, including Wisconsin, Michigan, and North Carolina. Follow us on the Twitters and Facebooks at On Point Radio. My guests this hour are Franco Ordonez of McClatchy, On Point's Jack Beattie, and Lisa Falkenberg of the Houston Chronicle. Lisa, I want to turn for a moment to what's happening in Wisconsin and Michigan. There are these moments where it appears as though these state legislatures are stripping away certain kinds of power. So in Wisconsin, the Assembly Speaker, Republican Robin Voss, spearheaded a bill to limit the power of the incoming Democratic governor and the attorney general. Voss spoke to the press before the legislation passed Wednesday morning, and he explained his motivation.
I respect the fact that Tony Evers is the governor, and he's going to be starting on January 7th. But he's not the governor today. And that's why we are going to make sure that the powers of each branch are as equal as they can be.
Lisa Falkenberg, I was in Madison, the state capital of Wisconsin, the week of those elections, a couple days after, and somebody pointed out Robin Voss at a gathering I'd sort of observed and said, this guy is going to try to kneecap the governor. What's happening up there?
I mean, watching from afar, I think that's clearly what's happening. I mean, the people pushing this have said, we don't trust, you know, the incoming governor and his supposed, you know, liberal intentions or liberal agenda for the state. And so we're going to protect the state by limiting his power. I mean, others are trying to claim that this is about, oh, maybe we should have done this before. This is just a balancing that's going on here. And we would do this for any governor. Well, why
didn't
they?
That is the state legislature would say, hey, listen, we're a co-equal branch of government here. We're not just going to sit and observe, right?
Right. So the question is, why now? Okay. And that's odd. I mean, I don't even know if this is constitutional. Questions have been asked. And the transfer of power is a very important part of American government. And what they're doing is limiting the governor's ability to make decisions or everything from early voting, which tends to benefit Democrats, to, you know, whether or not Governor-elect Evers is able to follow through on one of his main campaign promises, and that is to withdraw from a lawsuit challenging the ACA, otherwise known as the Obamacare. So it's frustrating. We haven't seen something like this in Texas, but it's just frightening that it's going on in America at all.
Frightening. Strong words. So we've got a call actually from Wisconsin, from Racine. Dan is on the line. Dan, go ahead.
Hi, David. Yes, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
You bet.
So my comment is basically around the you know, power play in Wisconsin, and it kind of shows a craven political nature of what I think the GOP may have become in our state. And I think the underlying reason might actually be national in scope, with Manafort and Flynn all coming to a head and possibly it leading to the top, you know, at the national level. And very rarely would you have a Speaker of the House who, you know, leaves in the middle of his speakership, maybe seeing the writing on the wall. So it is definitely a challenge to, I think, democracy in many ways. They also appointed 80 or so, you know, political appointees in this lame duck session. So as a Wisconsin voter and someone who is in Paul Ryan's backyard, it's deeply disconcerting. And I hope that whatever legal or other recourse can be taken to allow the governor, incoming governor, to be in the same position as the previous governor should be taken.
Hey, Dan, thank you so much for that insight from the scene, in a sense. Jack Beatty, why is this not politics as usual? Some reporters have pointed out when Jim Doyle, a Democrat, was leaving the governor's office, you know, Democrats tried to do some things, I guess, in the administration to load up, stock up agencies and other boards with his appointments in the last minute. Why is what's happening in Wisconsin and similar things that are happening in Michigan, why are they just not par for the course in politics?
Well, because they fit into a pattern, and the pattern was also seen in Florida, where President Trump was immediately calling into question the results of the election when it looked like it was going to disfavor his candidate. And even the governor of Florida was talking in those terms. The governor was reelected. And it goes to something, as Dan said, national and fundamental. I have repeated on the show a lapidary formulation of David Frum's, the former Bush speechwriter, who's written that if conservatives are forced to choose between conservatism and democracy, they are likely to choose conservatism. Now, think of that. That's to say that the attachment that conservatives have to their ideology supersedes their willingness to follow the democratic process. And I think we see just that in motion in Michigan and Wisconsin. And of course, it sets up this, you know, fright situation in the next general election. If it's a close election, what will the president do, and will conservatives support him if he decides to dispense with democracy?
Jack, can I just push back for a moment and on the artisanal words of David Frum? Is it fair to attribute that to conservatives generally, or is it fair to say that that's the case in terms of the elements controlling the levers of power in certain state legislatures and in Congress?
Well, I would like to say that it's just the leaders, but polls show a disturbing predominance of authoritarian sentiment among Republicans and conservatives. This has been well documented. And I would urge anyone who wants to read more of it should look at Vox, which did a big takeout on this. The polls are clear on that. And again and again, the question seems to be, if conservatives see that that the things they want are going, they can't get democratically, will they dispense with democracy? There is a sentiment among conservative voters that they would, a kind of authoritarian temptation.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if I could, I'd just like to
juxtapose
this.
Sure, Lisa, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I mean, getting back to President H.W. Bush, let's think about the beautiful piece that former President Clinton wrote after his passing, remembering the letter that President Bush had left in the Oval Office for him. So this is an example of the way American transfer of power is supposed to work. It was a bitter election, bitter campaign. Bush lost. What does he do? Does he have an 11th hour, you know, trying to stymie Clinton as soon as he's in office? No, he leaves this letter wishing him well and saying he's, you know, he's wishing him the best in his term. And so that's the way it's supposed to work. That's why somebody like Bush in today's context is viewed with such as being a very dignified individual with such respect, because this is the kind of thing we're seeing these days. And I don't think it's a I mean, I guess I would disagree. It's not inherently conservative. We've got people on the left who are so frustrated that they, too, are arguing that, you know, that we shouldn't compromise, that we should just advocate for our own little tribe. And that's mm-hmm. the scary thing about American politics these days. We're having fewer and fewer people in the middle who are able to see both sides and follow American principle, regardless of whether that works well for your tribe or your team or not. In that case,
you know, so interesting, Lisa, from what you say, admirable letter left by George H.W. Bush, and yet it didn't quite take, in the sense that, you know, he was the last of the presidents that people seemed to accept as truly there legitimately. I remember Clinton getting trashed essentially because he didn't break 50%. George W. Bush and President Trump didn't win the popular votes, and President Obama was disparaged with what turned out, you know, was a racist claim that he wasn't even born in this country. And so it is interesting to see what followed from, George H.W. Bush's relinquishment. We do have Badger Nation is representing. We got calls pouring in from Wisconsin. I briefly want to take a couple of them. Let's go to Juan calling from Madison. Go ahead.
Hey, David. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Yes, sir.
First of all, the from to quote Vox is hilarious, because that's nothing but a lefty liberal rag, and he knows it. And he's such a partisan Democrat, ultra liberal. I'm stunned he's even on this panel. The other thing is,
forgive me, David.
GOP and
go ahead, Juan. Sorry,
I'm proud that the GOP is standing up for themselves and taking the lead on it and realizing that they are a co-equal branch and they don't need to give the governor a free rein. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an excellent move. Lastly, Mr. Fromm needs to understand this is not a democracy. This is a constitutional republic. Maybe he should be schooled on such.
Constitutional republic. Thanks for that, Juan. And briefly, I want to take a call from Nate, who's calling from Milwaukee. Go ahead, Nate.
Hi, thank you for having me. I was going to say that this is the latest in a series of moves Republicans have done in with my state that is undermining democracy. And I'll point out the official title of somebody in the state assembly is representative, because they're supposed to represent people. And the Republican candidates for state assembly collectively got about 54% of the vote, and the Democratic candidates for state assembly got about the Republicans got about 45%, and the Democrats got around 54%. So the minority in the state legislature actually has a mandate to govern, but the Republicans have undermined the will of voters by gerrymandering, and now they are attempting to undermine the ability of the honestly elected governor by basically stripping his powers away when they gave them to Scott Walker early on in Walker's first term. I mean, this is not
Thanks. Thanks for that, Nate. So we have a strong vote in favor of what the Republicans are doing, a strong vote against. Very interesting to hear. You know, Franco Ordonez, there have been similar things going on with Michigan, but there's a different wrinkle in, I guess, related issues happening in North Carolina. There's a congressional race in which there have been fraud accusations. Those got more even heated with the Democratic candidate Dan McCready withdrawing his concession on Thursday. At a news conference later that day, Democratic representative and presumptive nominee for Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, commented on the race, saying the House still retains the right to determine who is seated.
This is bigger than that one seat. This is about undermining the integrity of our elections. And what was done there is so remarkable.
Franco Ordonez, what was so remarkable about what happened in that congressional race?
What was so remarkable is about those is that the accusations of potential fraud of these absentee ballots, and that these they were individuals who were being the witnesses on numerous numbers and numbers of absentee ballots in this county in kind of south central North Carolina that. In some believe may have tipped the scales for Mark Harris. Pardon me. You know, the margin of victory for Harris over McCready was only something it was less than 1,000. I think it was around 900 votes. So these kind of things make a big difference. But you know, any talk about ballot tampering is going to raise a lot of concern about you know protecting democracy, protecting votes. And it's unfortunate these kind of things are happening because you know there's been concerns in the past about these individuals, you know, kind of potentially using these kind of techniques to bring more votes to conservatives. And just talking about, you know, just adding to what Lisa and Jack were saying, it shows that some are willing to take any costs to make sure that their side wins. And they're going to these kind of extents. And it is very worrisome.
I mean, the most amazing thing about that in some ways is we've heard so much from certain elements of Republican Party about voter fraud. This isn't voter fraud. This is kind of election fraud. It's fraud seemingly being perpetrated on voters rather than by people trying to fraudulently vote. Franco, I want to talk to one moment about one last thing. There was this extraordinary investigation done by your colleagues in McClatchy down at the Miami Herald about an incredibly wealthy investor named Jeffrey Epstein who received what seemed like extraordinarily light sentences to almost little to no prison time for essentially procuring sex from underage girls. The amazing thing about it from a political sense was the U.S. attorney involved in some of those sentencing decisions is Alex Acosta. He's the labor secretary for President Trump right now. Why is this not a bigger issue? Why is this not a consuming scandal for the labor secretary right now and for the administration?
Isn't it incredible that it is not a more attention is on this? But I would expect that more attention will come. I mean, I would like to give a shout out to Julie Brown and my colleagues in Miami who did such a great job. I mean, basically, what it's saying is that it shows that you have different rules for people in power. And the fact that Epstein was, you know, rubbing shoulders, giving plane rides to people like Bill Clinton, Donald Trump, we're talking both sides of the aisle here, really can have an impact. And especially now in the Me Too era, for this kind of thing to go on and to have such a, you know, such a I don't want to say insignificant, but a 13-month sentence, considering the accusations that are out there. I mean, cult-like, you know, ring of young girls for sexual favors. I mean, it's quite amazing.
And what is Acosta said briefly as we wrap up this hour? What has Acosta said about this in the wake of your colleague's incredible investigation?
I have not heard. I think it's been pretty quiet, but I think he is certainly standing behind what he has done when he was a federal prosecutor in Miami.
You're hearing there the voice of Franco Ordonez, White House correspondent from McClatchy. Thanks so much, Franco.
Thanks for having me.
And we've been delighted also to have Lisa Falkenberg. She's vice president editor of Opinion at the Houston Chronicle. Great to have you with us.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
And of course, we've had our own On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Thanks, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can subscribe to the On Point newsletter right from our homepage, onpointradio.org, where you'll get weekly messages from Meghna Chakrabarty and myself. This week, I'll have more on the latest from the Russia investigation, my discussion with Robert Mueller biographer Garrett Graff. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.